Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. We're here because we want to promote and to defend public education. And the corollary of that is because we oppose state aid to religious schools, that the church and state should be separate, that even those people who have no religious belief at all should be protected. But unfortunately, in Australia, that went out when Section 116 was read down and out by the High Court. But now in America, unfortunately, this Trump Supreme Court is undermining the strong separation of church and state there. So that's our press release 1072, which Andy is going to give to you. And then a bit later, we'll be talking about what happens when churches and state get together?
Thanks, Jane. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1072. Trump receives report from Religious Liberty Commission in the Oval Office. A new report by a Trump administration commission suggests replacing the idea of separating church and state with the idea of building bridges between them. The assertion, challenging a long-standing concept in American law, comes amid a raft of recommendations in a draft report of the Religious Liberty Commission, released Friday afternoon. The advisory body was created by President Donald Trump last year and filled almost entirely by conservative Christians. The 224-page draft report, part policy document, part philosophical argument, echoes members' support for a stronger role for religion and religious expression in government, schools, and the public square. The report applauds recent Supreme Court decisions expanding rights to religious expression in public settings, such as creating opt-outs for religious objection to school lessons. The report recommends eliminating the Johnson Amendment that forbids political activities by tax-exempt religious groups, a long-standing goal of Trump. It calls for compensating military service members who were discharged for refusing COVID-19 vaccines. It calls in general for allowing more religious expression in the public square, greater access to public money for faith-based agencies, and broader exemptions for those claiming conscientious objections to policies ranging from vaccine mandates to pronoun usage to classroom lessons. It recommends that federal agencies publish Know Your Rights posters for various settings and establish hotlines to receive complaints about religious liberty violations. The draft report also calls for the creation of new honours, a Presidential Medal of Religious Liberty and First Freedom Hero Awards, and it calls for exhibits and markers at historic sites paying tribute to the role of religion in American history. The draft report is now available for public comment over the next 15 days. It is sure to draw opposition. Some other groups defend the separation of church and state. A coalition of groups, including one suing over the Commission's lack of ideological diversity, as required of federal advisory panels, issued a preemptive report earlier in June defending the concept of church-state separation. Religious liberty belongs to all people, not to any single tradition, political party or administration, said the report, published by the Centre for American Progress and others. Critics of the Religious Liberty Commission work say its perspective is skewed toward views favoured by Trump and his supporters, and that it heard almost entirely from like-minded scholars and activists. They say the commission failed adequately to address such issues as anti-Muslim efforts in Texas and elsewhere, and also the rise of anti-Semitism on the right, not just the left. The report comes as conservative states such as Texas have worked to incorporate more religion into public spaces, such as classrooms, including Bible lessons and Ten Commandments displays. Trump, speaking to supporters at a Faith and Freedom Coalition gathering in Washington on Friday, touted the newly released report. "We saved religion. It was going down," he boasted. Trump contended that the administration of his predecessor, Democrat Joe Biden, had carried out a reign of persecution. While the commission report downplays the separation of church and state, the commission didn't go so far as to call it a lie, as the commission chairman, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, did in April. But it largely took the stance that the idea is misapplied. To be clear, this does not involve or require advocating theocracy or even the total elimination of any separation between church and state, the report says. Rather, it calls for honouring a tension between the relevant clauses of the First Amendment that guarantee religious freedom but forbid any government-established church. Supreme Court rulings on church-state issues have evolved. The phrase, a wall of separation between church and state, does not appear in the Constitution, but it's embodied in Supreme Court precedent. Thomas Jefferson used that expression in a letter to Baptists, supporting them in opposing official churches in US states, a practice that soon ended. 20th century decisions by the High Court invoked the separation phrase to extend the First Amendment's prohibition on federal church establishment to state and local governments, citing the 14th Amendment's ban on states denying citizens' rights. That led to bans on official prayers and Ten Commandments displays in public schools. The Supreme Court in recent years has steered a different course, permitting such things as a public school coach's on-field prayers and a religious opt-out for parents objecting to a lesson on transgender issues. The draft report contends that even Jefferson didn't believe in completely banishing religion from public life, but rather in keeping church and state in a kind of balance. In reality, the church and state strengthen and support one another, it says. The report touts the value of religion to society in terms of providing humanitarian work, anchoring families, and acting as conscience monitoring government. In many cases, the law protects the religious expression of Americans, but government officials and employers often use fear tactics to silence individuals into believing that they don't have the right to publicly express their faith, it argues. It argues, citing one of its own members, Catholic media figure Bishop Robert Barron, that notions of strict church-state separation can be traced to a God is dead ideology that originated in Europe and saw traditional religion as an opponent to individual autonomy. This way of thinking made its way into the American culture and courtroom, the report said. Little recognition for non-religious Americans. The report, while touting the value of religion, appears to give little emphasis on the large population of Americans with no religious affiliation. A key argument of many atheists and secular humanists is that one can be good without God, that religion doesn't have a monopoly on virtue and can do harm as well as good. The lawsuit challenging the commission, filed by the Interfaith Alliance and other religious groups, says its lack of ideological range is sown in that the commissioners have asserted that America is specifically a Judeo-Christian or Christian nation, and that most commission meetings took place at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, an institution with Christian leadership. The Republican administration is asking a federal court to dismiss the lawsuit. The government is citing legal technicalities and contending the law does not define how a commission should be fairly balanced or whose viewpoints should be represented. This draft report comes 2 months after another entity created by Trump, the Task Force to Eradicate Anti-Christian Bias, issued its own report. It claimed that Christians faced discrimination under the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden in areas such as education, tax law, and prosecution of anti-abortion protesters. Progressive critics said that the report failed to prove its case and amounted to advocacy rather than an investigation. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. It's a sad day, isn't it? But news from America seems to be getting sadder and sadder all the time. And of course, we have our own problems here in Australia. The story we're now going to tell you, stay listening, because I think it beggars belief. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jane. This is a Sydney Morning Herald article by Emily Kowal with Amelia Adams and Natalie Clancy. Parents pay $10,000 a year to send their children to this Sydney private school, but it doesn't pay its teachers' wages. Teacher salaries account for about two-thirds of every school's expenditure, but not at Redeemer Baptist School. An acclaimed Sydney private school with an extensive property portfolio has raked in tens of millions in government funding in a decade, all while its teachers go unpaid, relying on a small stipend and, for some, Centrelink benefits. Redeemer Baptist School in North Parramatta promises parents a disciplined education. Sharing the same leafy parklands as the King's School and Tara School for Girls, Redeemer's students boast high ATARs and win state science competitions. It's been praised in Parliament and is visited by politicians and dignitaries. But behind the accolades lies an unorthodox, but perfectly legal, financial structure that has allowed the Redeemer organisation to amass its real estate empire. Recently, the Sydney Morning Herald revealed the extent of the Redeemer Baptist Church's control over its members' private lives, from orchestrating careers and marriages to dictating household structures. Its school operates without a single paid employee, records show. Instead, its teachers and support staff are classified as volunteers, made up entirely of members of Redeemer Baptist Church. It's the accounting equivalent of opening the bonnet of a car and instead of seeing an engine, seeing nothing, Sydney University accounting professor Clinton Free said. I've never seen anything like this. Several ex-students and staff have told this masthead about the financial and psychological toll of this arrangement, the zero-wage school. Professor Free examined Redeemer Baptist School's financial records from 2015 to 2024, describing the arrangement as a deeply unusual set of accounts that raise a whole raft of issues. Over the past 10 years, the school received income of about $106.7 million, comprising $52.7 million in government grants and $54 million in parent fees and other income. While this is standard for a private institution of its size, the outflows are unconventional. Its 2025 annual report shows half of its expenditure to be non-salary expenses, and a further 16% to be services rendered and allowances. If you look at published databases on costs in public and independent schools, we see that labour costs typically amount to somewhere between 60 and 75% of overall expenses, Free said. In this case, what we're seeing is zero. Because none of Redeemer Baptist School's teachers are classed as employees, standard rules, such as paying superannuation, do not apply. Redeemer did not specifically answer the Herald's question about paying superannuation. Instead, staff are classified as members of the Ministry Order of the Redeemer Baptist Church, a religious order involved in the practice, study, teaching, and propagation of the Christian faith. The stipend is paid at a discretionary amount whether members work or not, and members regard their work as voluntary. Responding to a calling, they forego wages in exchange for a modest church stipend, which sits below the threshold for welfare benefits. Some highly qualified full-time educators also collect Centrelink benefits, many former church members said. These payments can include family tax benefits and Aus-study. It certainly seems like there's a risk of a double payment here, that the public purse is effectively funding the school to pay teachers, Free said. In some cases, at the same time, teachers are drawing on social welfare payment instead of wages. Most Australians might reasonably ask, if a school is receiving public funding to teach students, why aren't teachers being paid? Redeemer said that individual members of the community may, of their own volition, apply for Centrelink benefits, but that neither the school nor the church relies on benefits in any way. For those inside the church, the financial structure serves as a mechanism for control. One former church elder explained that school funds are transferred to the school, which then pays stipends to people who are formerly part of the church ministry. The stipends vary, but generally sit at about $2,000 a month. The minimum award wage for a teacher in New South Wales is $7,515 a month. Because the church covers housing, electricity, gas, and vehicles, members become reliant on the institution. There's no superannuation. There's no personal investment for your future, the former elder said. You are held captive by their financial system, and the older you get, the worse it becomes. The members can't survive without the church. For younger members, the pipeline into unpaid labour begins immediately after graduation. Ex-students, who are also part of the church, are expected to complete a year 13, a gap year of unpaid volunteer work. Female students are typically assigned to work as teachers' aides, handle homework, or run the uniform store. Male students often work for the church's building services team. Redeemer said it did not monitor or control members' finances. All members of the Redeemer's ministry order, it said, had chosen a lifestyle of sacrifice, and the church encouraged volunteer work by Year 13 students if they wished to do so. It said that some members of the order receive a stipend for support. Michael Jones was born into Redeemer Baptist Church and attended the school from kindergarten to Year 12. During his unpaid gap year, Jones was provided with a roster and directions to work for the building team from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., followed by paperwork until 5 p.m., while also leading school camps and maintaining the home of the school principal and church elder, Jonathan Cannon. Their ethic is work, Jones said. It's non-stop work. It is so you don't have time to think. After university, the only way Jones could receive any form of payment for his labour was to sign a ministry order and receive a stipend. In doing so, he renounced, in principle, any possessions or property, and agreed to make any self-sacrifice to uphold the goals of the order, even if this results in loss of material well-being. After signing, Jones said that he was pressured by Cannon and headmaster and elder Russell Bailey to work at the school as a temporary teacher, despite possessing an engineering degree and having no teaching qualifications. He taught unaccredited, with a teacher sitting in the back of the classroom for 3 weeks before starting a Master's of Teaching through an online college. Redeemer told me I needed to get conditional accreditation to teach on my own, and I was like, hold on, this was meant to be a temporary thing. I kept getting pushed down the road to be a full-time maths teacher. That was one of the biggest things that led me to make the decision to leave, Jones said. One former student and church member bluntly described feeling like an indentured servant. The relationship between the church and members of the ministry order is formed on a voluntary basis. You get home at the end of the day with nothing, and you are just exhausted for the next day already. It was very soul-destroying. If the school isn't paying teachers a salary and related employee entitlements, where is its $106.7 million in decade-long revenue going? The answer lies in a highly complex, legally protected, closed-loop system. When the school needs to construct a building, fix IT systems, or sell uniforms, it doesn't always hire independent businesses. It pays another arm of its own enterprise, Redeemer Baptist Services Limited and Redeemer Baptist Church Property Limited, because these separate services and their property arm are registered as charities, they are exempt from income tax. The service charity runs 10 commercial businesses, including Redeemer Baptist Constructions, Redeemer Baptist Uniforms, and a bookstore. Money is shuttled from the school to these businesses without paying corporate taxes. Free said this appears to be a tightly integrated internal economy, with the school generating the income, the services entity capturing internal spending, and the church sitting above the structure. The model appears to allow the network to have it both ways, the benefit of the charitable status and the practical advantages of keeping commercial activity largely inside the house. What deserves scrutiny is the combination, public-facing charity status, internally controlled service provision, related party flows, and a governance structure that appears highly concentrated. The New South Wales Education Standards Authority said that state government funding must contribute to the educational needs and outcomes of students, but it does not require the funding to be used on employment costs. Jones, who has since left the church and started his own engineering business, said the number of entities that Redeemer has to move money around is astounding. As a business owner, I would love to be able to do that. I would love to be unethical, he said. Despite his view, there is nothing illegal about Redeemer's financial arrangements. Redeemer said the governance and operations of its entities adhere to Australian regulations and laws. It said its school meets the requirements of the New South Wales and federal governments. Unlike the school, the services arm reports 10 casual employees, accounting for $213,229 in employee expenses in its latest reporting period. The majority of work remains done by volunteers. The construction arm is particularly lucrative, said a former elder, relying heavily on the unpaid labour of male graduates graduates completing their gap years. Free said the building services made significant money. That money would be pooled back into the finances and called not-for-profit because the profits were not distributed. Redeemer Baptist Church itself is classified as a basic religious charity, meaning it is exempt from submitting financial reports to the government. On paper, each charity is a distinct entity. Yet in reality, financial records show this entire network of school, charities and businesses is largely controlled by the same tight-knit circle of men, including Jonathan Cannon and Russell Bailey. New South Wales Education Minister Prue Carr and Federal Education Minister Jason Clare said the allegations were deeply concerning and very serious. Clare has referred his department to investigate the school, and Carr said it was entirely appropriate that NESA is investigating. The Federal Assistant Minister for Charities, Andrew Lee, said, "I have referred the concerns raised in your reporting to the Charities Commission." According to real estate data, Redeemer Baptist School owns 37 properties worth more than $67 million, in addition to the school's campus itself, which is jointly owned by the school and the church. The properties encompass residential homes in Oatlands and a sprawling camp. By holding these properties within a religious structure, Redeemer takes advantage of tax concessions. Free observed, "This is an unusually asset-rich environment. These properties house church members as well as domestic and international homestay students, another lucrative revenue stream. Some international students who pay from $20,320 to $33,280 a year are housed in cramped bunk rooms inside community members' and teachers' homes. The school said it has no reports of students, including international students, being forced to stay in any teacher's home. One former international student recalled being required to wake early to wash buses, collect firewood, mow lawns, and clean community members' homes. Despite the school saving millions of dollars on salaries and receiving $14,851 per student in government funding, parents who pay an average of $10,895 a year are still subjected to a relentless cash grab," one parent said. Invoices obtained by this masthead from 2024-26 reveal a pattern of unitemized goods and service fees. One mother who demanded an itemized receipt discovered that she was billed for a printed participation certificate for a sports carnival. "The job of regulators is to identify unusual relationships and structures like this and to investigate them," Free said. "If you have an organisation drawing tens of millions of dollars in public funding, transparency becomes absolutely essential. Financial reports show non-salary and service allowances account for 66% of the school's expenditure." During a 2006 court case, the school's then bursar Russell Bailey said at the time that the services charges were mostly paid directly to the Redeemer Baptist Church. This is not the first time the school's financial structure has faced scrutiny. Between 2005 and 2007, then New South Wales Greens MP Dr. John Kay used parliamentary privilege to accuse Redeemer of operating an extraordinary tax sham and welfare fraud that is costing the federal government up to $910,000 each year. Documents cited by the Herald show that the federal government became aware of the financial arrangements 2 decades ago, but did not consider the model required further scrutiny. A huge number of churches, charities, and community groups operate and are powered by volunteers, Free said. But I think the question to be asked here is looking at substance over form and label. If workers are being directed by the school in terms of hours and expectations, are these people volunteers or are they employees? In 2006, a court upheld that they were volunteers. It's been 20 years. There's a lot that warrants attention here. I think it's in the public interest that regulators look closely at this institution. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. Well, it does beg a belief, doesn't it? But it's also very sad. Let's have a break.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to us, but I'm sorry, we've got another rather nasty story about the shenanigans that religious people get up to, even though they get billions of dollars now of public money. And this is what happens, of course, when the churches are too close to the state. And these people are in charge of children's education. Let's hear from Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. And before I get started with this article, I would just like to warn listeners that this article will be discussing child sexual abuse and pedophilia. This article is entitled Christian Brothers Sold Real Estate Worth Millions for $1. Now it claims in court it lacks money to pay abuse survivors, and was written by Christopher Knaus for Guardian Australia. Adam pauses briefly, his voice catching slightly down the phone line. He's contemplating how to describe the unprecedented new legal tactic the Christian Brothers Catholic Order is deploying against him and hundreds of other abuse survivors. It's not human, he says. It's just not human. The Christian Brothers had an oversized role in the church's industrial scale abuse of children. A staggering 22% of its brothers were alleged perpetrators, the second highest rate of any Catholic order. Like many church institutions, Royal Commission findings revealed the Christian Brothers was aware of abuse complaints, but continued to circulate pedophile clergy through its vast network of schools and orphanages, a practice that allowed offending to continue. Between 1980 and 2015, 1,015 people made child abuse claims against the Christian Brothers, the highest number of claims against any Catholic order. The claims identified 483 different alleged perpetrators across 100 Christian Brothers schools. Now, the order is telling a court it is broke. This week, the Christian Brothers applied for a court-ordered moratorium on all remaining civil cases lodged against it by survivors. If granted, it would permanently halt at least 200 civil claims. The order says it wants instead to sell its remaining property portfolio, 36 properties worth about $216 million. And divvy up the leftovers between a range of creditors, including survivors using a scheme run by retired judges. It has already confirmed the sell-off will not provide enough cash for it to pay creditors all of what they are owed. But a trove of church property records obtained by Guardian Australia tells another story. One that survivors have not been made aware of. A Guardian investigation can reveal that the Christian Brothers has spent the last decade transferring large multi-million dollar property holdings for amounts of $1 to a separate Catholic Church entity, which is not part of the proposed sell-off scheme. The beneficiary of the $1 property deals is Edmund Rice Education Australia, an independent organisation created in 2007 to assume control of schools previously associated with the Christian Brothers, like Waverley College in Sydney, Trinity College in Perth, and St Joseph's Najee College in Brisbane. Property records reveal that in New South Wales alone, the Christian Brothers transferred 26 separate portfolios to Edmund Rice Education Australia for amounts of $1 or $0 between 2013 and 2024, with most of the transfers occurring in 2018. The properties are now worth well over $50 million. They include multi-million dollar homes around schools in the Sydney suburbs of Waverley and Strathfield, as well as school buildings and vacant land. The most recent transfer involved a 5-bedroom Strathfield home, complete with a backyard pool, in November 2024. The property currently has an estimated value of $4.7 million. Edmund Rice got it for $1. The transferor, Christian Brothers, acknowledges receipt of the consideration of $1, a document detailing the transaction says. Many of the transfers were signed off by the Christian Brothers Oceania leader, Peter Clinch. Edmund Rice Education Australia was designed as an administratively and financially separate entity to the Christian Brothers, despite being named after the Christian Brothers founder. It continues to hold vast wealth, reporting net assets of $2.3 billion and $345 million in cash as of December 2024. The $1 transfers have now left the Christian Brothers without control of a significant pool of assets they could use to pay out survivors. An EREA spokesperson signals it will not be selling property to help the Christian Brothers. The spokesperson says EREA is not responsible for the financial affairs or liabilities of the Christian Brothers. In 2007, EREA was established as a separate legal entity, and it was entrusted with responsibility for governing, operating, and stewarding the schools solely for the advancement of its educational mission. As part of the process, the school assets were transferred from the Christian Brothers Oceania province to EREA, together with the associated school property. The spokesperson says, the diversion of school assets or funds to support the liabilities of another organisation would raise significant governance, fiduciary and regulatory issues, they say. We sincerely hope the Christian Brothers find a path through their challenges, including planned asset sales, to allow them to continue their commitment to supporting survivors and victims of historic sexual abuse. The spokesperson says the 26 properties identified by The Guardian were all either buildings or vacant land near existing EREA schools. The land and property was transferred as part of a slow, progressive process of turning over Christian Brothers school land and property to EREA, a process delayed by what the spokesperson describes as the complexity of transferring individual titles across multiple jurisdictions. The transfers represent the completion of a governance transition that commenced almost a decade earlier, the spokesperson says. A spokesperson for Christian Brothers Oceania says the scheme it is proposing would be able to scrutinise property transfers to EREA. Our current advisors, in respect of the scheme of arrangement, were not involved in the establishment of EREA or the transfers of property by the province to EREA, the spokesperson says. Under a scheme of arrangement or liquidation, there will be scrutiny of the property transfers to EREA and the parties involved in those transactions. Christian Brothers says EREA has not responded to requests to provide financial assistance. We confirm that as of 26 June 2026, no funding from Catholic bodies, including the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference and EREA, in response to our requests, has been forthcoming, the spokesperson says. The Australian Catholic Bishops Conference President, Archbishop Timothy Costello, says, it is the great hope of the conference that the Christian Brothers find a way to support the provision of care for victims of abuse that occurred in institutions conducted by the Christian Brothers and now operated by Edmund Rice Education Australia. Adam has been fighting for justice for 5 years, including in the High Court. He was abused by Brother Robert Best, who was convicted of the crimes and allegedly abused by brother Gerald Fitzgerald, who died before any conviction, while at the St. Alipius Boys' School in Ballarat in the 1960s. He suffered a serious heart attack about 18 months ago. The latest legal manoeuvre has him left reeling. "It's just so hard to keep my head above water," Adam says. "I went out to one of the counsellors yesterday in person to try and get some sort of sense into my head. When are they going to admit it, have accountability and be human about it? It makes me feel disgusting that I'm even listening to what they're doing." Plaintiff lawyers representing hundreds of abuse survivors say they were blindsided by the moratorium push. Judy Cortin, a lawyer who represents Adam, says she first learned of the church's plan on Monday and was handed hundreds of pages of documents on Tuesday evening, just before a Wednesday morning hearing in the New South Wales Supreme Court. Plaintiff lawyers were granted an extension and the court will return next week to consider the matter. Cortin says the plan has caused immense harm to her clients. "This reflects their whole MO, using the black letter of the law to destroy and crush victim survivors," she says. Other lawyers with claims against the order have reported a similar impact. "No one else has done this in Australia. This is the first time," Jason Parkinson, principal at Porter Lawyers, says. "In the early days, the church would say, 'We don't exist. We can't be sued.' Quite frankly, this just seems to be a variation on that theme. We've got people who are in for hearings in September and are distraught. This is just rubbing salt into the wounds of victims of child abuse." The Australian Lawyers Alliance says it is appalled at the legal strategy. The Alliance's national president, Ian Murray, says its members will fight the church on behalf of their clients. "This latest legal manoeuvre by the Christian Brothers follows a pattern the Royal Commission documented in damning detail. Delay and deny justice to survivors," Murray says. "These are not abstract legal disputes. They concern children who are harmed by individuals in positions of trust and in circumstances where the church failed in their duty of care. Every procedural tactic used to avoid compensation compounds that original betrayal." During the evidence to the Royal Commission in 2017, Clinch, the then Christian Brothers Oceania leader, said the order was in our final years. It has stopped seeking new candidates and its existing cohort of brothers was aging, Clinch said. "It is my opinion that if you look at the statistics and you look at the evidence that is around us, we need to be gracious in our final years and make sure things are in place. For example, Edmund Rice Education Australia, who can do that work effectively and well," Clinch said. In 2018, Clinch's signature appeared on many of the documents transferring property to Edmund Rice Education Australia. He died in 2024. A Christian Brothers spokesperson says it is not attempting to stop survivors suing other institutions, including EREA. The moratorium and property sell-off scheme would only be created with the support of creditors, the spokesperson says. "The proposed scheme of arrangement is entirely in the hands of our creditors, who will be invited to vote on the scheme," the spokesperson says. "If the creditors do not wish for there to be a moratorium on claims and do not support the scheme, then the province entities will enter liquidation." As stated publicly on the 22nd of June 2026, neither the moratorium nor the proposed scheme of arrangement, or indeed liquidation if that scenario eventuates, is in any way intended to prevent any future civil claim being brought by claimants against EREA and other Catholic institutions or any other potential defendants, the spokesperson says. Adam remembers how alive he felt during the Child Abuse Royal Commission. It was the first time he felt heard. Now, when they're manipulating the laws the way they are, it's like we don't exist. Back over to you, Jean.
Yes, well, it's a sad world, isn't it, when you have entanglement of religion with the state? And it's pretty sad for genuine Christians, I would imagine. Money corrupts, doesn't it? And power corrupts too. But the two together, yes, you've got problems. Well, here's Jeff, who's going to take us back over to the US, where the entanglement of religion with the state is pretty rife now under President Trump.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is from the USA Today, and it's by Janine Santucci. Bible stories become required reading in Texas public schools. This is after, by the way, Texas had passed a law saying they have to have the Ten Commandments up in classrooms. It begins. The Texas State Board of Education on June 26 approved a mandatory reading list for public schools that includes select stories from the Bible. The measure includes a list of texts that would be required reading during each grade level in all the state's public schools and includes Bible stories and verses in grades ranging from elementary to high school. The move has kicked off a polarising debate over religious freedom and religion in schools. There were over 5.5 million students enrolled in public schools in the state during the 24-25 school year. Those students already view the Ten Commandments listed in each classroom after a state law requiring them was upheld by a federal appeals court. The State Board of Education, which has a Republican majority, approved the proposed reading lists in a 9-5 vote on June 26th. These are the Bible stories that could be on the Texas reading lists. The reading lists came as a result of the 2023 Texas law requiring the Board of Education to develop vocabulary and reading text lists for each grade. Texas is the first state to have such a mandatory reading list, the Associated Press and Education Week have reported. The lists included standard literary texts commonly read in public schools, such as Johnny Appleseed in second grade, Charlotte's Web in third grade, The Phantom Tollbooth in fifth grade, and Great Expectations in high school. There are also works on the nation's founding fathers and other historical figures. It also includes Bible verses or adapted Bible stories in many grade levels with a required version of the Bible from which the passages are to be read. These are some of the required religious texts. In elementary school, first grade have to read Noah's Ark by Peter Spear. In second grade, David and Goliath, an excerpt from the Children's Book of Heroes, edited by William J. Bennett. The fourth grade, Book of Luke, chapter 14, verses 7 to 11, The Necessity of Humility, from the New International Reader's Version of the New Testament. Fifth grade, stories about Moses from the Book of Exodus, chapter 3, The Burning Bush, and the Book of Exodus, chapter 14, The Parting of the Red Sea, from the New International Reader's Version of the Hebrew Bible Old Testament. In middle school, they have to read, sixth grade, Book of Matthew, chapter 6, Do Not Be Anxious, from the English Standard Version, New Testament. Seventh grade, Book of Psalms, chapter 23, The Shepherd's Psalm, from the King James Version, Old Testament. Seventh grade, Book of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 1 to 12, 8 Beatitudes, from the King James Version. Eighth grade, Book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, To Everything There's a Season, from King James. Eighth grade, Book of Lamentations, chapter 3, from the Tanakh, Jewish Publications Society, 1917 edition. In high school, they have to read the Book of Luke, chapter 15, verses 11 to 32, Parable of the Prodigal Son. Book of Job, chapters 1 to 7, verses 11, 14, 19, 28, 38 to 42, from the New International Reader's Version of the Hebrew Bible Old Testament. The Book of Genesis, chapters 2 and 3, Adam and Eve. Book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 13, The Definition of Love, from the English Standard Translation, New Testament. So those are now required reading in Texas. Notice that nobody is reading, let's see, The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, The Greatest Show on Earth by Richard Dawkins. No, none of that. And let's see how well a Bible-infused education treats them in Texas. Anyway, with that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Cheerio for now.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Well, let's come back to Australia, shall we? Our state schools throughout Australia have to deal with every child. It doesn't matter where they are. And the state governments are responsible for what's called distance education. But up there in Queensland, the parents out in the outback are not very happy with what the state government is doing, as they channel millions and billions into the private schools. They're slashing funding for some of the most needy children, those who are geographically disadvantaged. Over to Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from ABC Rural News. Parents angry as state-run distance education slashes learning materials. Parents are angry over a decision to phase out essential resources for country kids who learn by distance education. The information has been used for decades to assist children who learn remotely. Parents want to return to full step-by-step lesson materials. Every school day, 7-year-old Vivian Fitzgerald heads to school on a remote cattle station. In between mustering, branding, fencing, water point checking, weed management and housework, her mother or father joins her as her very own home tutor. But parents are now doing it without the information distance education families have used for decades to support their kids in the remote classroom. Her English Today has been cancelled because the teacher has got other commitments in the school or might be away, Mother Ellen Fitzgerald said. But because that's only taught online, I don't have a framework for what to teach her during that period of time. Every day, Ms. Fitzgerald and her husband, Mick, balance the education of their daughter with the reality of working a 24,000-hectare cattle station between Winton and Muttaburra. Schools of the air were built across Australia so that every child could have a good education no matter how remote their home. But in Queensland, the lesson plan style resources, known as correspondence or papers, are being phased out, falling behind city peers. Unlike homeschooling, schools of the air involve qualified teachers delivering online lessons to remote classrooms of students who live hundreds of kilometres apart. When students cannot make online lessons, families can use a printable booklet of step-by-step instructions, independent learning materials, ILM, to catch students up. Ms. Fitzgerald said the substitute lessons were essential because they gave her flexibility to provide correct, curriculum-aligned instructions at any time during the day. We could actually say, we can't get to that on-air lesson, we'll be in the paddock, so you can do your maths lesson in the paddock, she said. This is what we need to learn, these are the activities, these are the materials you need, these are the writing sheets you need. Everything you need, you would bundle up. Families will usually print the digital documents as booklets so lessons can be held anywhere on a property, from the shearing sheds to the stockyards. But Ms. Fitzgerald said her daughter was now online for longer. Her time spent on air has more than doubled, and it's a lot to ask a little person to sit on a screen and learn in a lecture style, she said. Muttaburra grazier Winnie Blatt, who has had 3 of her children enrolled in distance education so far, said the materials were necessary when something went awry. That might be on days when the power goes out, on days when you don't have stable internet, on days when you need to go mustering, on days when someone in the family has a major medical appointment and we all have to go away together, Ms. Blatt said. She said the documents were fully scripted, lesson-by-lesson instructions that meant anyone could pick them up to teach the daily curriculum. All the different scenarios that are our reality out here don't fit into the full-time on-air structure, she said. Without ILMs, it takes away our choice to be flexible. Under the rollout of version 9 of the Australian curriculum, the Queensland Education Department has slowly been phasing out ILMs. A department spokesperson said families were instead receiving new curriculum support materials with a full set to be completed by the start of 2027. But Ms. Fitzgerald said the new support materials were nothing like the old ones. She said a document provided to parents and seen by the ABC said the new materials were not created for every lesson, in every sequence, in every unit. For example, the new Year 1 English unit will have 8 curriculum support materials, but ILMs had as many as 32 lessons. When asked about this difference in scope, State Education Minister John Paul Langbrook said he would work with remote families. "We've established a formal working group to make sure that the materials meet the needs of geographically isolated students and their home tutors," he said. "But we'll take note of the numerical contrast if they were 32 and they're now 8 and people feel like they're drowning in a lack of knowledge." Mr. Langbrook said paper-based materials were important backups during internet blackouts, but online learning needed to adapt and evolve. He said there were 16,000 students currently enrolled in state-run distance education in Queensland, including 745 who are geographically isolated, a significant number. Ms. Fitzgerald said the new materials needed big changes. "Regardless of what the department wants to call it, at the end of the day, we need to know what to teach our kids," she said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. Now, last week we did promise you that we'd give you the rest of the material on what is happening up in Queensland with the private school funding, but we haven't got time, but we will put a link to it on our podcast. But let's have a break and come back to our good news story.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs for our good news story. Anyone who was watching the ABC this week for the 50th anniversary of the Australian Chamber Orchestra under Richard Tognetti would have seen a delightful sight. These school children up on the stage with some of the best musicians, not just in Australia, but in the world. And these children came from a very special school where the Chamber Orchestra Foundation is teaching the children to play music on stringed instruments. Let's hear about this great state school, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is St Mary's North Public School in New South Wales, in the outer western suburbs of Sydney. Work earnestly, live honestly. St Mary's North Public School offers an innovative music program that has been developed in partnership with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. The ACO Foundation's program seeks to significantly improve the emotional, physical, social, and cognitive development of our students through the teaching of a musical instrument from a young age. Research suggests that learning to play an instrument such as the violin or cello between the critical age of 5 and 7 leads to permanent changes in the way that the young brain processes information, therefore positively impacting on a child's learning ability in all areas. The research suggests that such changes to the brain, impacting on areas such as the phonological loop, may occur after a period of 3 years of such intensive musical learning. Since the program's early beginnings in 2019, which saw a pilot group of 25 students offered the opportunity to learn to play the violin or cello, the ACO Foundation's program has grown immensely, with over 170 students now participating. Our entire Year 1, 2 and 3 cohorts engage in daily music lessons, along with students from Years 4, 5 and 6 who are part of our Super Strings Ensemble. The ACO provides specialist music educators who visit our school every week, allowing each student to have individual or small group lessons weekly. Also provided are daily videos and supporting materials for the classroom teacher to lead with the class. This is a vital part of the program as it allows practice to occur on a daily basis. Our little musicians have been afforded many opportunities to engage with Richard Tognetti and the ACO. At a once-in-a-lifetime event, our students were invited to play alongside the Australian Chamber Orchestra at their 50th birthday gala at the Sydney Opera House. This was a memorable night for all involved, and yet another opportunity for our students to shine on stage alongside the greatest string musicians in Australia, if not the world. We believe our students should not be defined by events in their life or their circumstances. We strive to build a world inside our gates that is filled with the belief that our students can achieve. They are important. They have options. A rich music education through ACO Foundations not only improves learning outcomes, it allows our children to dream of a future filled with endless possibilities. To be able to see firsthand the difference that music has made for our students and their families has been one of the most significant highlights of my career. And that's a quote from Mrs. Lisa Perello, the principal. We recognise the ongoing custodians of the land and waterways where we work and live. We pay respect to elders, past and present, as ongoing teachers of knowledge, songlines and stories. We strive to ensure every Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander learner in New South Wales achieves their potential through education. And now some facts and figures from ACARA. The school has 345 students. 27% have a language background other than English, and 29% are of Indigenous heritage. The ICSEA value of the school is only 873, a fair bit below average. That puts 2% in the upper 25% of socio-educational advantage, 9% in the second quartile, 20% in the under 50% quartile of socio-educational advantage, and 69% in the lowest 25% of socio-educational advantage. It costs the taxpayer $20,163 to educate a student at this school. The school receives $1.43 million from the federal government and $5.5 million from the state government, $64,556 from fees, and $89,767 from private fundraising. Only $994,000 was received for capital grants in the last 3 years. Their NAPLAN results, considering the ICSEA value of this school, are very good indeed. Perhaps all that music tuition really supercharges their cognitive and emotional development. And Jean, as a musician myself, I 100% concur. That is definitely what's happening. Music is great. Back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to St Mary's North Public School up there in New South Wales, and especially to those lovely children who were on the Opera House stage in the last week. So our time is gone. It's time for me now to thank our producer, Dale, and also Sorrel and Jeff and, of course, Andy. And if you want to find out more about us, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.